Thank you very much, Professor Conway. It's a great joy for me to be back in Vancouver. And I must say, after the snows of Ottawa and the weather you've laid on, I feel particularly grateful to the powers that be and to Cecil and Ida Green, whom I've not met, but to whom I feel eternally grateful for this change from our winter. I want to talk to you about some political problems, big ones, because I think that in the years and the decades ahead, we're going to have to face problems and challenges on a world scale that are as great, perhaps greater, than any in mankind's long history. I've been asked to talk on this vast topic of the North-South dialogue or rich-poor relations in the world and its implications for Canada. I hope to leave a little time for questions, so you'll forgive me if I have to deal pretty summarily with some very complex issues. And if that provokes you, I hope there'll be some time left for you to have at me. In the middle of the last century, Karl Marx tried to predict the future by a theory of economic determinism. So profound was his moral fervor and his concern about inequalities and injustice among men. Marx was in the tradition of the great Hebrew prophets of a couple of thousand years earlier, that his political influence has been global and of the first magnitude. His actual forecasts, nevertheless, proved remarkably misleading and erroneous. His economic analysis was, I think, brighter than that of most of his contemporaries, in that he focused dynamically on a factor that was clearly destined to increase, that is, capital. And he tried to draw the implications of the projected increase in that factor. I think he drew the wrong conclusions, but there's a lot to be said for that technique. The communist revolutions, which he predicted, didn't take place in the highly industrialized countries, as he expected, but in the predominantly peasant societies of Eastern Europe and China. But they did take place. I agree with Marx's remark that the purpose of philosophy is not to explain the world, but to change it. Personally, I do not believe in any form of material determinism, whether economic, geographic, or whatever. I give primacy to the human imagination and will, to values and motivation, to what makes men tick. But as a part-time practicing futurologist, and I'm chairman of the board of the Hudson Institute of Canada, I might mention, though I leave most of the futurology to the staff. But as a part-time practicing futurologist, I do suggest that a study of objective aspects of our environment that are likely to expand can help us to anticipate problems, scenarios, and challenges, and therefore can help us to plan less short-sightedly than we might otherwise do. And I want to suggest that we focus on the implications of a couple of elements that I think are key in our human situation and are clearly expanding and likely to continue expanding. One of these is imagination and knowledge, and the other is interdependence. Frank Scott, that rather fine Canadian poet and discerning political analyst, once wrote that we grow to one world through the enlargement of wonder. Meanwhile, the enlargement of several other things is pushing us in this direction. One of these is an increasing knowledge, at least superficial, about how other men live. This information explosion creates, among other things, a demand for less inequality, for more sharing of the world's resources, for the elimination of absolute poverty. As Saul Bellow put it in a recent book, what has always been has become intolerable. The fact of poverty isn't new. What is new is the elimination of poverty in a significant part of the world, the enormous increase in production here in the West, and now recently in the Soviet Union also. The awareness of students, of teachers, and of political leaders or would-be political leaders throughout the world of how the other third, the rich third, live, and of course the inevitable frustration and demands that awareness of this gap, and it's still a growing gap between the rich and the poor, inevitably produces. Of the many problems on the world's political agenda, I think that development is the most important, because unless reasonable progress can be made with this and be seen to be made towards the development on a global scale and the eradication of poverty on a global scale, it is, I think, certain that other problems, such as those posed by nuclear proliferation or the expansionist ambition of empires or the management of the environment and resources, will become more perilous and more intractable. Frustration can lead to irrational thinking and action. Desperation can be dangerous. I've suggested that in our day, the ability to imagine some things at least has enormously increased. And I think that this is very much to the good. It's a great leap forward in human self-consciousness. In our age, responsible leaders everywhere imagine and pay at least lip service to the goal of a world where the minimum in food, health, shelter, and education that is essential for human dignity can be assured for all men and women. Now, we're a long way from getting there, but this is now clearly the demand of the leaders of the Third World, and it's a very reasonable demand. And undoubtedly, they are determined to make it louder and louder until they are assured of some progress towards meeting it. On the question of methods, of course, there's much less agreement than on this question of goal. Though even on methods, there is movement. The fundamental problem is a problem of political will, and this brings us back again to the question of motivation and values. Now, for a lot of reasons related more to our history and experience than to our geography, our economy, and resources, I believe that Canada can, if we wish, play a very significant part in shaping developments in international relations during the next quarter century, and not least in the field of what's coming to be called North-South relations. It's important to understand why and how, but I won't have time to go much into the Canadian side of things today. I'll be speaking more about that at another lecture on Saturday. I want to outline some of the problems today. But it can help us, I suggest, if we appreciate our many and substantial sources of strength. I think Canadians sometimes underrate their capacity to influence world events. Before becoming a university professor here a couple of years ago, in Canada, I mean, I spent some 35 years professionally engaged in one or another area of world politics. For some 25 years in appointive jobs in various parts of the world, Russia, Indochina, Middle East, Western Europe, or at the UN and other international organizations. And then for 10 years, I was in an elective and a very political job. I had, I think, one of the world's smallest electorates. There were only 20 people who elected me to a 5-year term against some 6 other candidates. There were 28 who re-elected me to a second 5-year term. After I told them in 74 that I wasn't going to be a candidate for a third term, there were 36 who elected my successor, Sonny Ramphal, a very good friend, then foreign minister of Guyana. But these 20, or 28, or 36, represent over 1 billion people. The job involved an awful lot of travel, a lot of hair-raising problems, but I can assure you it was never dull. It also is a very fair approximation to perfect freedom. It says somewhere that the service of God is perfect freedom, and I'm sure that's true. But on a more mundane plane, if you have 36 bosses and you're not responsible to any one of them alone, but only to the lot of them collectively, it's not bad. Now, I want to suggest something about the tremendous changes in the nature of international politics in the last few decades. The chessboard theory of international affairs may still have some appeal to representatives of great sovereign powers, though it's increasingly apt to lead them into policies and postures that are inadequate. Naturally, that theory has less appeal to smaller nations. It's based mainly on pre-World War II European experience, which proved a good bit less than ideal. I think it's a very inadequate approach. I don't personally like the phrase international affairs, though I've nothing against affairs, as much as I like the phrase world politics, because I think that's a much more significant description of what it's really all about. Thinking merely in national terms is becoming almost as much a prescription for failure in foreign policy for the national government concerned as thinking in merely egocentric terms is a prescription for deserved failure on the part of an individual in domestic society. Despite the variety, I think there's a common element in constructive politics. The object of political activity is to develop, or should be, to develop or maintain a better community and neighborhood for oneself and one's children. A neighborhood more secure, more comfortable, more attractive and creative. To the extent that politics is legitimate, and it of course is not always legitimate, but to the extent that it is, that I think is always the objective, the goal. Except for nihilists and others rather sick in mind, and there are plenty of those around, power and influence are among the means of politics, not the ends. You'll remember a couple of thousand years ago, a lawyer asked a young rabbi, "Who is my neighbor?" And instead of getting a definition, he got the story of the Good Samaritan and then the question, who was more neighborly? And the suggestion, when he answered that he'd better go and do likewise. Now, the point is that neighborhood is merely a fact. A good neighborliness, on the other hand, is a moral and a political achievement. And with technological advance, the fact of neighborhood is growing, and growing quite remarkably. Neighborhood, I think, can be defined as the area within which people can move about readily and discuss things with each other, exchange goods or ideas, or throw things. Once it was measured by how far you can walk or shoot an arrow with a bow, but today, with ICBMs and satellite television and shortwave radio, obviously, for a number of purposes, the scale of neighborhood is already global. And it's going to become increasingly global. More and more problems will be soluble only on a global scale within the next decade or two, unless we have a catastrophe such as a nuclear holocaust that brings a technological advance to a halt. Now, this means that our generation and the next face the challenge of building a harmonious world. Already, as I've suggested, there are many problems that can be solved only on an intercontinental scale. One of these is inflation, if you please, though I must say I'd like to see our government do a bit more to help with it here. Others are obviously nuclear proliferation and management of the ecology and so on. Cynics have suggested that governments always pursue their national interests, and that is simply not true. If it were, we could all relax, because everybody's interest is peace and prosperity. The disasters of history come from governments pursuing what they conceive to be their national interest and misconstruing it or misinterpreting the environment in which their actions will work or failing to anticipate developments outside their borders or within that will affect them. There are lots of disasters, and they come from not pursuing your national interest. So the cynic's interpretation of international affairs is just so much a hogwash, though you still read it in books solemnly printed and sold by good publishers even today. During the next few decades, we're obviously faced with the task of lifting mankind to a far higher degree of understanding and cooperation and justice among peoples than has ever been attained in the past. This awesome but inescapable challenge is the inevitable corollary of increasing interdependence. It doesn't mean moving towards any dull uniformity. I think the purpose is to aim at a world that is safe for cultural diversity. Another change in the world in the last few decades has been the flowering, if that's the right noun, of international organizations. When I was unemployed in 1938 and I just got married, and I managed to get a magnificent honeymoon with a ringside seat to watch the world go to hell by getting a temporary job with the League of Nations Secretariat. It was during Munich. Since World War II, there have been an enormous number of new international organizations, many of them in principle universal, like the United Nations and its great family of specialized agencies. And then there are a lot of continental and regional organizations. There are caucuses of the rich, such as the OECD and the Group of Ten, and lots of caucuses of the poor, the non-aligned summits, the Group of 77. And there are the Commonwealth and the Francophonie, which are based on the concept of using similarities of working language and of some cultural, professional, and administrative habits to foster understanding and practical cooperation among peoples of different races and continents and economic situations. And there are cartel-like groupings of people who produce similar primary products such as oil or bauxite. I think there's great value in people belonging to different groups. I would think there could be great danger in the world, nations of the world, gelling into exclusive, inward-looking blocks. And this could happen. One of my many battles when I was in a fairly central position in the Commonwealth was trying to fight against the dangers of European isolationism on the part of Ted Heath and some of his cabinet and some of his officials in Whitehall, or of African isolationism in some parts of the OAU, or of occasionally, though not so much here, North American isolationism among some of my compatriots. But this could be a great danger. There are other important developments that result from this flourishing, and again I'll use the quotes if you like about that word, of international organizations and the multilateralization of so many problems and so many methods of diplomacy. Toynbee suggested, 20 years ago or so, that if you establish quasi-parliamentary types of international organizations, you enormously enhance the potential influence of the middle power. And he cited Canada as an example. And of course, this is true, and it explains in part, in significant part, why Canadians have been rather keen on developing and strengthening international organizations, why we pushed for NATO to get the Americans committed to what we saw as a vital interest in the freedom of democracy also in Western Europe. We'd seen that in 1914 and in 1939, and it took 2.5 years in each case for them to come around to share our assessment of a common danger, and we weren't sure we might have 2.5 years the next time. But having a North Atlantic Council also gives one a chance to express views about the policies of bigger friends who otherwise might take unilateral decisions that would affect one for good or evil without one's own input. Obviously, the middle power has an interest in organizations. But Aristotle, Toynbee's remark was good and was true. But a couple of thousand years before that, 2200, I think, or 2300, Aristotle suggested that once you create a democratic assembly, you make it inevitable that sooner or later the poor, who are many, will use their voting power to gain concessions from the rich, who, he said, are few. Now, that observation is just as accurate on the global scale, I suggest, as it is on the scale of the city-states which Aristotle had in mind and was discussing. And I suggest this is all to the good. I lived through some of the beginnings of what I call the growing lobby of the poor. I was lucky enough to be a Canadian representative at the Economic and Social Council of the UN in 1947 and 48. And there were a lot of transfers from North America to Western Europe to reestablish the war-ravaged economies and put back on their feet people who, after all, were our important trading partners of ours. I remember the Lebanese ambassador, a man named Malik, and the Chilean, Santa Cruz, it was a different Chile in those days, saying, "This isn't good enough. You're just going to reestablish all the inequalities of the pre-war situation." They wanted to get in on this transfer of resources, and quite rightly. I remember Malik saying to his fellow delegates at ECOSOC, "You dare not leave the underdeveloped countries to stew in their own juice." And while the Europeans have been trying to write into every resolution, special regard must be paid to the attention of the war, to the interests of the war-ravaged economies, these people started a lobby to write into almost every resolution, special regard has to be paid to the interests of the underdeveloped countries. And of course, things have gone a long way since then. With the decolonization of the 19 of Asia at the end of British Asia at the end of the 40s, and then of Africa in the 50s and 60s, and other parts of the world in the 60s, you got an enormous increase in sovereign states. You had the non-aligned meetings, a reaction against Dulles's very inadequate bipolar concept of the world on the part of Jawaharlal Nehru and Tito and Nasser and Sukarno. They pressed at first for decolonization and so on, but they soon turned their attention to ways and means of improving their economic prospects of these developing countries. I think, as I suggested, that this has been very much to the good. And you got UNCTAD in Commonwealth meetings. We had a great deal of to do with the development of cohesion in viewpoints and in pressures from developing countries. Most of my clients, as I call them, or electors, represented poor countries, and I was lucky enough to have the opportunity on a few occasions, some important ones, of trying to help work out agreed lines and common ground. One of the most important was connection with the EEC, which through a deal between Pompidou and Ted Heath, offered Yaoundé Association to Commonwealth countries in Africa and the Caribbean and the South Pacific. Now this, in effect, said we will give you a lot of aid and we will give you free entry to our markets except for agricultural products that interfere with our common agricultural product policy. That was most of their products, by the way. We will give you this aid and this free entry if you undertake to discriminate in our favor against all the other industrialized countries of the world. And if you don't, we won't. And we're going to discriminate against you in favor of those developing countries that do. Well, at a meeting of Commonwealth finance ministers in Nassau in 1970, the African and Caribbean and South Pacific finance ministers, puzzled by this offer, as well they might be. Nkrumah had denounced the whole concept earlier as neocolonialism, and it certainly was. They asked me for advice to undertake some studies on the considerations that they should look into in connection with this offer. And over the next couple of years, my colleagues and I did organize a number of technical studies and meetings and so on. But the part that interested me was the political advice of telling them, for heaven's sake, don't under any circumstances accept this offer. But don't do as the Nigerians and some others want to do and reject the whole thing. You're big boys. Put forward counteroffers and stick together. If you stick together, I think you can get what you want. If you don't stick together, God help you, the weakest among you, and that would be the majority, will have to take it or leave it. Now, to ask African countries to take or leave the loss of the British market and of the aid prospects from the EEC, many of them would have taken it. reluctantly, regrettably, Nigeria and one or two others with very strong leaders, such as Nyerere and Kaunda, I think would have said go to hell, but many of them would have felt they had to take it. But to ask the West Indian countries to lose their British market for rum and bananas and sugar, or undertake to discriminate against the United States and Canada, to ask Fiji to undertake to lose its British market for sugar and its aid, of course, prospects from Britain and the Europeans, or undertake to discriminate against Australia and Hong Kong and India, and of course the Africans and the West Indians and the South Pacific Islands, to discriminate against the Russians and the Chinese. What did neocolonialism mean then? This was outrageous, an outrageous choice. And though it must say it caused a lot of flack, the developing countries of the Commonwealth, the ACP countries, did decide to stick together. I suggested they also get in touch with the Francophone countries because maybe they could be persuaded to join them. Maybe they would see the advantage of not undertaking reverse preferences. We developed such contacts. And eventually, you got Lomé instead of Yaoundé. Now, Lomé is not perfect, but it's so much better than the idea of Europe carving out, through aid offers, a discriminatory sphere of influence for itself, that it's almost as night and day. That was an important stage in the cohesion of the poor. Another important stage was OPEC. I wouldn't call most oil exporting countries poor, though Nigeria is. Its per capita income was $70 a year only 4 years ago. It's less than 200 now with a different dollar. But the fact that the OPEC countries could change the terms of trade by cohesion among themselves sent a galvanic thrill through the leaders of the third world. Now, the higher oil prices hurt them much more than it hurt us. I think, basically, the higher oil prices were a very good thing. They're not what caused our inflation. It was already underway. But they did force us to begin to pay some attention to alternative sources of energy, to more exploration for energy, to trying to develop recurrent, renewable energy sources and so on, a little more emphasis on solar and things like that. I think it's been, on the whole, very good. But in the short run, of course, it's been costly to us. Okay, well, we can afford it. It's been terribly costly to most of the poor countries of the world, and they can't afford it. Now, what's been happening is that they've been borrowing money from Western banks. Their indebtedness has been increasing. It's been on short term. They've been increasing at the rate of some $15 billion a year, I think, in the last year or two. And it's expected by the World Bank to increase at several times that rate within another few years. And some of the oil countries are depositing short-term their surpluses with these euro banks. And this creates a financing problem, which is not going to be easy to deal with. But this alliance between the oil countries and the world's poor, again, has been a very interesting political development. Now, I'm not going to say this is all to the good. I think it's done some good. It could do damage over the long run if it leads to confrontation between any two of the oil producers, the poor of the world, which I don't include most of the OPEC countries, or the industrialized West. I think confrontation among any two of those could be very costly. It also, of course, raises a very interesting and difficult question as to what about the Soviet Union and her allies. So far, they've been sitting out the North-South dialogue. They occasionally give very dramatic aid. I was delighted when they picked up the tab for the Aswan Dam. I was ambassador in Cairo, and I like the Egyptians, and the dam promised to increase the arable land, and it has increased the arable land of Egypt by a third. It took 7 years to build, and in those 7 years, the population of Egypt increased by a third. But at least it helped them stay in the same place by running pretty hard. But basically, the Russians have been sitting out the aid part of the development dialogue. That's only one part, but it's an important part. Last year, for which I have statistics, they gave $500 million, which is 0.04 of their GNP. We're all pledged to give 0.7 of GNP. The OPEC countries are giving 1.35 of theirs. Some of the Scandinavians are actually giving the 0.7. Canada is about 0.58 2 years ago on 0.5, I think, last year, slipping a bit and promised to go back to try to catch up this year. Germany, 0.4. But the Russians, 0.04. In other words, they're not pulling their weight on that game. But they don't get criticized by the Third World because they give support to some very key things, to the liberation movements. And this makes them deservedly popular in many of the Third World and mutes the criticism that otherwise would be directed towards them. I want to say a little bit more about this Soviet attitude to North-South politics. I was invited to visit the Soviet Union the last week of November and early part of December by the Soviet Academy of Sciences. I had to give a couple of lectures, but I also had an opportunity for some quite fascinating talks with members of the Central Committee of the party, and I really wanted to probe this question of whether they thought in the long haul that détente, which I favor and certainly a lot of them favor, is going to be possible over the long haul between East and West as a merely bilateral thing while they sit out and don't pull their weight vis-a-vis the Third World and perhaps make anti-Western propaganda as they're doing. Their representatives at the UN have said poverty is the result of imperialist exploitation. They weren't responsible for the imperialism. Therefore, they have no responsibility for this. Well, that's a phony theory of what caused the poverty. It's also a phony theory of ethics. Responsibility comes from the opportunity to shape the future more than from what you did or didn't do in the past. That theory would let Canadians and Australians and Scandinavians off the hook, too. But anyway, so far, that's what they've been doing. Now, I suggested to them that in the long haul, this was not going to be compatible with bilateral détente, that also it would be very desirable to do something about disarmament far beyond the SALT talks and the sort of thing that are being envisaged between the great powers. The world is spending now something between $350 and $400 billion a year in armaments. I suggested that at the maximum, half of that would suffice to produce an adequate degree of overkill all around, and that maybe half of that saving might be used to help speed up development and lessen the dangers for all concerned in this shrinking planet. Now, this is going to be a difficult thing to arrive at. I suggested that in the short run, it mightn't be a bad thing to have a joint venture between Canada and the Soviet Union in some development project in some mutually agreed country, politically not slanted too much one way or the other, cooperating either in exploration for resources or in building a hospital or building a dam, putting up $10 or $12 million each, say, or the equivalent. Something that might have a psychological and political spin-off on a smaller scale, but in this field of North-South politics, analogous in its minor way to the psychological and political spin-off of the Soyuz Apollo effort in space. I hope that something may come of this. I also suggested, since Western banks have been loaning money to the Soviet Union and their allies to the tune of about $50 billion last year, and it's growing at a little over $5 billion a year, that it would be a good thing to develop methods of making some of this financing self-liquidating. I'm all for exchanges with the Soviet Union. I've been for them for a good many years, but not as a one-way street. And I suggested that it couldn't go on indefinitely as a one-way street, and that perhaps Canada and the Soviet Union, which have more in common than any other two countries in some areas, like working on permafrost and northern development and so on, might cooperate in search for new energy in eastern Siberia, say, and they might export some of that to us, and maybe if we don't need it ourselves, we can re-export it, and we can both make money out of it. Well, maybe something can come of that someday, too. I want to leave aside this very big question of what the Third World is going to do and come down to a brief examination of what the poor of the world are demanding politically. They're seeking, of course, more resource transfers, not chiefly in the way of aid, but in a good share of the profits of the proposed International Seabed Authority. The haggling over the seabed has gone on so long that countries with big coastlines, such as India and Nigeria and Canada and United States, have extended their exclusive economic zone by 200 to 200 miles. And this, of course, is the biggest territorial expansion in human history. Meanwhile, the haggling, I think very foolishly, goes on about whether the seabed authority will itself be a monopoly that undertakes all of the deep sea mining beyond that 200-mile zone, or whether it can license some of it to private firms. I hope the latter, but in any case, the important thing is to agree. It seems to me very desirable that a good share of the extra profits made from the extension of territorial economic zone from 3 or 12 miles to 200 should be given by all the countries with territorial seas of this magnitude to international development purposes. There's some measure informally of move towards agreement that maybe 20% of the net proceeds from these sources might be so used. That's a very modest percentage, but it could come to a good many billions and could help. Anyway, that's one thing that the poor want. Another thing is commodity agreements with buffer stocks so as to iron out fluctuations, and that's a very reasonable thing, in my judgment. They would also like to see the terms of trade, if not shifted in their favor, at least action taken to prevent them continuing to shift, as they have done over the last 20 or 30 years, rather markedly against them in relation to manufactured goods. Now, we've done all these things in Western democracies. You know about parity prices between agriculture and industry in the United States. That was one of Roosevelt's basic ploys, I think, that kept the Democrats in power for a long time. We have parity policies in Canada that my friend Mr. Whelan looks after, and no doubt his colleagues as ministers of agriculture in this and other provinces. They suggest that some of the things that we've done within the last couple of generations in Western democracies should be done on a scale beyond the national. They suggest that more of their raw materials should be processed in their own territory. Now, this is something that Canadians ought to be able to sympathize with. We produce a lot of wood pulp, and it's easy enough to ship our wood pulp to the United States. We can even ship newsprint. But when it comes to fine paper, the tariffs are quite a lot higher. And it gets so that most of our users of fine paper find it cheaper to buy the fine paper there. If we can't sympathize with developing countries, we ought to have our heads read on these things. What they want, I think, are pretty legitimate. They're not easy. But they really amount to an extension to the global community of some of the things that have been done within large Western democracies first, and then more recently in countries like the Soviet Union. Some of these things Canada first invented. I won't be talking much today about Canada in particular, because I'll be doing that more on Saturday, but certainly some of these things were originally Canadian ideas. Now, these demands, as I say, I think are not unreasonable. They're not all that easy. It's not hard for a politician elected by voters in all parts of Canada to go in for equalization policies and freight rate policies and so on that do something to lessen inequality in our huge territory. We invented that kind of policy. It was followed later by the United States. It was followed by Nigeria, especially after the Civil War. It was followed by the Soviet Union, especially after Stalin. One of the demands is that this sort of thing be done on scales that transcend the national. Now, politically, of course, that's a very much more difficult thing to do. You've got the beginning of regional policies on an international scale in the EEC. It's not very big yet, and the Italians and the Brits and the Irish will hope it'll get bigger, and you can bet your life that the Greeks and the Italians waiting in the and the Greeks and the Portuguese and Spaniards waiting in the wings, I hope so too. Well, what I suggested is that the demands of the poor thus far are, in my mind, quite reasonable. They're really analogies of what has happened domestically in our own great societies. Now, the extension of equality of opportunity and of affluence in Western democracies in the last couple of generations has not really been because of an enormous increase in human goodness. I believe in human goodness. I also believe in original sin. But by and large, I think it's been because we realized, with the growth of interdependence in Western democracies in this century, that it just wasn't going to be safe to expect to continue living much longer in a society one-third affluent and with good education and good medical facilities, and two-thirds poor and with inadequate medical facilities, so that you might get diseases that, heaven help us, might be contagious even in the better suburbs, with less education than is necessary for economic efficiency and production or for personal fulfillment. Now, those same factors are going to become increasingly true, I suggest, on the global scale during the decades immediately ahead. And that really is what the North-South Dialogue is about. I want to put one other point to you, and then I'll leave, I hope, a few minutes for questions. And that is that it's not just a matter of economic development. And economic development, by the way, is not just a matter of economics. In fact, I think it's not even primarily a matter of economics. It's a matter of the educated imagination, the curiosity, the ability to conceive, and the will to apply oneself to make change happen. I remember visiting an Indian village in 1954, my first visit to that country. And I was on my way as commissioner to Indochina, but I stopped off for a fascinating week there, since they were also a member of the Indochina Truce Commission. And I was taken to this village by the head of an agency then called the Village Development Agency. And things were as they'd been probably for a couple of thousand years. And he said, you know, our most difficult job is getting these peasants to imagine, to conceive that change is possible. Once we make them realize that change is possible, then the necessary energy will be forthcoming to cooperate with us, and we can make change happen. But before that, we really can't do anything. And that's the hardest part. Well, I think a lot of our aid administrators have focused too exclusively on economics, but that's a big topic that I won't go into now. Another aspect is race. I mentioned the Russians getting a free ride, roughly, on the aid question, because they have helped the liberation movement. In my judgment, it's been an extraordinarily short-sighted and indeed a stupid aspect of Western policy in the last 10 or 12 years not to help liberation movements where justice is on their side and where the powers that be make peaceful change impossible. I urged in 1965 that paratroops be dropped on Salisbury. If it had been done, I suggested, and since then I've learned that I was absolutely right, that they wouldn't be fired on because the governor was against the unilateral declaration of independence. If the Queen had made a speech and said that she was sending in some reinforcements for the governor, most of the leaders of the Rhodesian armed forces of the time would have rallied to these troops under the governor. There's no doubt about that now, because we know that 7 of the top 10 officers went to the governor immediately on the declaration of UDI with some Tommy gunners and said, please authorize us to go and arrest Ian Smith. And he wouldn't. He was against UDI, but he was also a coward. Anyway, that wasn't done. I urged it again in early 66, and it wasn't done. I urged it again in September 76. And again, I think it could have been done at probably no cost, certainly a very limited risk compared to the risks that we now face of a very ugly war. Ian Smith had said he accepted majority rule within 2 years. Kissinger, who paid no attention to African problems until Cubans got it in the game in Angola, suddenly got very excited about it and took some very useful initiatives. And he persuaded Forster to put the heat on Ian Smith, and Ian Smith agreed to this. Well, I think if some paratroops from Nigeria and Canada and India and Jamaica and Britain had been landed then with a new governor and a pretty speech from the Queen saying that she welcomed this decision to move to majority rule and was sending in a governor to preside over the negotiations that would be necessary so that they could take place in Salisbury, I don't think they'd have been fired on. I think people were off base on the side of the rebels. But again, this opportunity was not taken. In the meantime, a monopoly of support for the freedom fighters in Mozambique and in Zimbabwe and in other countries where you have a racist minority rule has been left to the totalitarians. I suggested in a public speech broadcast to Rhodesia a couple of years ago that it was important to avoid wasting the future as 11 years had already then been wasted, that it was important to realize that the situation was transformed by the new independent government of Mozambique. And I helped put them in touch with Suarez, the Portuguese foreign minister, and get talks going. I promised him a good bit of Commonwealth help, by which I meant Tanzanian and Zambian. I was in touch with Gond, of course, in Harare at the time. This did lead to an independent Mozambique. Somana Machel promised me that he would stop traffic to and from Zimbabwe, though he wanted a couple of years to prepare for that, and we gave him technical assistance, and he's since done it. Now, it's important to understand that, in effect, the freedom fighters, the Frelimo, caused the war weariness of the Portuguese army, which freed the Portuguese people from fascism. Freedom fighters, in other words, did a good job. In Rhodesia, we then had the opportunity for negotiations. I suggested that the white Rhodesian leaders, the illegal leaders of the illegal regime, had been very clever, but far from wise over the past 10 years. They'd been playing to divide the African nationalists among themselves. The Cuban and Russian providers of arms and advisors had been playing for the same thing. Somebody was miscalculating, but they were both trying to do the same thing, and they both succeeded. I expressed the hope that the splits, which made an agreed solution more difficult, would be healed, that now that power was getting within sight, the nationalist leaders would come back together and stick together, rather than each seeking for his power at the cost of a possible civil war against the others. And I expressed the hope that the white leaders, the Rhodesian Front leaders and other white representatives, would be wise enough not to seek short-run clever advantages at the expense of their obvious long-run interests in interracial harmony and goodwill. As a minority, they should realize, I said, that the prospects of a successful multiracial society would depend on their being generous now, and on trying to retrieve the respect and confidence of the African majority, which their short-sightedness during the past 11 years had so greatly jeopardized. I also said that it is to be hoped that the leaders of the African majority will be wise enough to know that moderation and generosity on their part toward the white minority in Zimbabwe would greatly improve the prospects that the white minority in South Africa itself might be won round to the conclusion that it would be better for them also to seek to come in out of the cold into an international community where justice and equality among peoples of different races is recognized as an indispensable basis for stability and prosperity. Well, the question, what's going to happen there, is still before us, and I don't propose to predict. But I do suggest that in a lot of fields, racial and economic, North-South politics and all its ramifications is going to be crucial to the future of the generation of those of you who are students. And indeed, it's going to be crucial to the few years that those of my age, I hope, still have left too. Thank you very much.
Kindly agreed that he would be willing to take a few questions for a few minutes. Have that. Yes.
Yes, I would like to ask you a question regarding China. China is a third world country, and I'm wondering how you saw China's position on the way so important for the population.
Yes, it's very important, and I, if I'd had more time, might have mentioned it, but I must say to my sadness that China is the one really big part of the world that I've never visited. I've been on the North Vietnam-Chinese border several times, on the Northern Laos-Chinese border, and of course often in Hong Kong, and also I've been on the Soviet-Chinese border, but I've never been in. I hope to remedy this omission. Well, I find China fascinating. I think their policy toward the Third World has been imaginative and very welcome. I tried to persuade the West not to be so stupid as to reject the pleas of Kaunda and Nyerere to finance the Tanzam Railway, but they wouldn't. They kept saying that they could extend the railway that ran through Rhodesia and South Africa. Imagine Canadians not knowing that you build railways in part for political reasons. Good God. But anyway, I think that it was a very good thing for China and for Africa and for the world that the Chinese did step in there. It helped to lessen Chinese isolationism. I admire what they've done. I wish I knew the country better, but I'm glad that quarter of the world's population is there, and I think they're really developing.
I hope you get that.
Thank you. South Africa chose to withdraw because its apartheid policies were clearly unacceptable to other members of the Commonwealth, and they were not prepared to, at that time, to modify those policies. I think that there is always a cost in the loss of contacts. I'm a great disbeliever in non-recognition. If the devil had a kingdom on this earth, I would send one of my brightest young men to be ambassador to him, to keep a good eye on what he was up to, and to see whether you couldn't even persuade him to take a more long-range view. But on balance, I would prefer to belong to a society that includes Nyerere and Kaunda and so many of the African countries, and I'm not going to defend Idi Amin if that's your next one, and that stands for cooperation and equality among races than I would for one that, though it included South Africa, excluded all of the non-white races, and they probably would have not remained, you know, and certainly the new ones coming up in wouldn't have joined. So on balance, I think the views that Diefenbaker expressed at the time were the right ones. Yes?
What is your view of the recolonization of South America by the United States, and the role these countries are playing or not playing in the North South Africa, Chile, Argentina, Brazil?
Well, I personally rather like Jimmy Carter's emphasis on human rights as one of the criteria in foreign policy. I don't know whether you said decolonization or recolonization. I am all for interdependence as a two-way street. I think the Americans sometimes in the past have tended, as far as Latin America is concerned, to think in terms of the one-way street. We dish it out and they have to take it, and I think that's been short-sighted. I think if they'd played their cards right with Castro and with Ho Chi Minh, they both would have been just as independent-minded nationalists as Tito has proved to be. I was in Moscow when Castro first arrived, and I must say, you should have seen the embarrassment on the part of Khrushchev and his colleagues in the Presidium when Castro went around calling them comrades. It just wasn't done, you know. To use the word comrade, you had to be accepted as a member of the Communist Party, and he wasn't. But Khrushchev was bright enough when Castro persisted in this to think that he could make some mileage out of it, and I think they went ahead and cooked up sidearm persuaders, you know, missiles, and thereby hangs quite a tale that we don't need to remember today. Yes? I don't speak for the Canadian government, but I've got a good many friends who are involved in Canada's policy in this matter, including Michel Dupuy, the new head of CEDA. There's a lot of emphasis in CEDA's new policy on trying to ensure that a significant amount of its aid, the largest amount, will be focused at improving the lot of the poorest sections of the community to whom the aid goes. Now, ensuring that this happens isn't very easy. I think that the international community and donors have been, in many ways, too soft. If the Brits get into trouble with their balance of payments, or the Italians, the International Monetary Fund doesn't hesitate, and hasn't, to tell them that you will change this policy and that policy and the other policy, and you'll stop spending so much, and so on and so on and so forth, or you don't get your loan. But the World Bank does not do that kind of thing with a developing country. It's somehow considered an interference with sovereignty. I think the World Bank's got to get around to ensuring that you don't depend merely on divine providence for the benefits of growth trickling down, but that you do something to ensure it. And I think there's beginning to be pressure on donors and on big institutions like the World Bank to adopt more of the view that, as you rightly say, has been pushed by some of the better NGOs. Yes? Ensuring that you don't depend merely on divine providence for the benefits of growth trickling down, but that you do something to ensure it. And I think there's beginning to be pressure on donors and on big institutions like the World Bank to adopt more of the view that, as you rightly say, has been pushed by some of the better NGOs. Yes.
I was wondering, sir, more on the term subjective. That would basically some similar argument. You see the process as one by which the standard of the globe comes out closer to our own, or whether it's the sort of meaning of the ways.
I see it as one in which, if we play our cards right, the standards will rise towards the kind of affluence that we have. I think that if we play our cards well, we can bring about, on a global scale, something analogous to what has happened in industrialized countries in the last two or three generations. The demands of organized labor and farmers and so on have brought about a number of measures like the parity policies and the equalization payments and so on and so forth. And on the whole, this has increased productivity and increased wealth. It hasn't really taken away from the rich. Maybe your tax rates went up for a while, or mine. I wish I were rich enough to have them go up all that much. But basically, what we have done in industrialized countries, and this includes now the Soviet Union, has been to increase the productivity and thereby the standard of living of the poorer sections, not at the cost of the rich. I think what Henry Ford did by saying we'll have a minimum wage of $5 an hour, and then maybe these guys will be able to, my workers will be able to buy the tin Lizzies. Very analogous to what Khrushchev, a man whom I greatly liked and admired, did, you know. He got rid of the slave labor camps that Stalin used to build all his railways and canals and virtually all his roads and to run his mines. He got rid of almost all of that, and instead started paying bonus wages. The further east you went in Siberia and the further north you worked in Siberia, the larger your wage rates. And the price levels are identical throughout the Soviet Union, whatever the transport costs. Now, of course, putting Europe back on its feet by Marshall Plan and the $1.25 billion Canadian loan, plus the $3 billion from the Americans. I was secretary of the Canadian team that negotiated this, and I found it fascinating at the end of 45. This was really helping to put back on their feet people who already had the infrastructure and the psychology and the technical know-how and the self-discipline and social cohesion to be productive after a destructive war. The job of development in countries where you don't have self-discipline and so on is a vastly greater one, but let's not think that we want to make them images of ourselves. We're beginning to get to be the kind of people who don't work, by the way, aren't we? And the Japanese and the Koreans and the people in Formosa, the kind of people who do work. But I see the long-term prospect, and it's going to take a century or so, but we've got to get seen, perceived motion towards it, can be to move towards markedly increased standards of production and consumption on the part of the peoples of developing countries. Now that's far more important than lessening what's called the gap. In due course, everybody will consume more or less what he needs to consume. They may own different amounts in Swiss bank accounts or somewhere, but the standards of personal consumption will not be all that different. And I suppose the time may come I don't hope it doesn't come through the means that some of Marx's followers have advocated, but I think it may come, his vision that someday, to each according to his needs and from each according to his ability. I think that's a realistic forecast of a state of affairs that's still some little way in the future.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Smith. That's a very fine global view from which to make. We're extremely grateful to you for this overview. And as you rightly said, the scope of the problem is such that we've only heard a half of it. Those of you who want to continue this dialogue with Mr. Smith would very welcome to come and hear his speech on Saturday night at the Vancouver Institute lecture at 8:15 in the IRC, number 2, at 8:15 on Saturday, in which he's going to address himself particularly to the Canadian contribution to this problem, which is so fascinatingly outlined for us this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.